Okay, so we got to the question today that in spite of Earnshaw's theorem, which you remember says there can't be a stable structure, one that you could vibrate around, if you have inverse square force laws, it's still possible that Lewis is right, that there are shared pair electrons between nuclei, and that's what holds atoms together. Because it might be that Coulomb's law is wrong, although we now know it's right. Okay, so we're going to look at ways of seeing whether there are where the electrons are, and what the bonds are. And we tried. I put this on my new machine, and whenever I transfer from one file to another, it changes the backgrounds that I put there. This is supposed to have a black background. Oh, I see. It's this one that... Let me... Or is it this? It's probably this one. And that... I look... You remember we didn't have the pictures this morning? They're there, but they don't show up. Go figure. So I'll try to get that fixed up once I figure out how to use this thing. No, that's not right. I'll just have to read the yellow. I'm very sorry. I apologize. Okay. So atomic force microscopy is a way to feel tiny things. And I'm going to pass around. This is a silicon chip that's coated with gold. And if you look at it in this bug box, you'll see drawn on the bottom, you can see that the background is black and there are yellow Vs like these things down here. So this is one of those chips. And if you tilt it so the lights from the room reflect off the gold and look carefully at one end, you might be able to see those little Vs. Okay, so I'll pass that around. Anyhow, this is 1.4 millimeters from here to here, and there's a line and then a number of different size Vs. Could you see it, Lauren? Did you see the little Vs? Okay, they look like that if we blow them up compared to the size of a hair, which is 100 microns. So the scale division on this optical microscope image is 20 microns. So if you, in any one experiment, you only use one of these things that are called cantilevers because they bend. Okay? And here's one of them out there. And you see at the very tip of it, and now we have a scale of 50 microns, so this is half as wide as a hair. Right? And you can see a little dimple there. And if you look at that more carefully, you see it looks like this. It's a little pyramid. These are made the same way people make the integrated circuits that are in your computer microfabrication things. Okay, so that's called the tip. And the tip comes down to a very sharp point. The radius of curvature at the tip is 20 nanometers. And remember, a nanometer is the size of a molecule. An atom is a couple tenths of a nanometer. Okay? So the curvature of this thing at the bottom, the radius, is only about, this particular one that you're looking at, is only about 20 nanometers, so 20 molecules. In fact, you can buy sharper ones, right? But that's the one I'm passing around is not of that sort. Okay, and now this is that gold chip, and it mounts on that glass piece that I had here this morning. If you came up to look at it, it's held by this little piece of wire here. And these tips are all here, pointed with their points coming up toward you here. Okay, and then you put it down here so that those little tiny points are pointed down. Right? And it looks red because there's a laser up here. And the laser shines down and reflects off the back of one of those cantilevers, and there's the tip, grossly magnified so you can see it. Okay? And it reflects off the gold that's on the top of that and bounces back up here. So like that. Now, if I were to push up on this thing here, what would happen? This thing is anchored back here on the glass, on this piece of glass. What would happen if I push up here? Right. right? This will get, it'll bend up and that'll twist, right? It'll go like that, right? So what there's, there you see the laser that's bouncing off this and going, you can see it in that window, the fact that you've got it in the right area. And up there, there's a thing called a split diode. Whoops. A split diode. So when light hits it, it generates a voltage. But it's split. So the beam comes and hits both sides of it. But if the beam is displaced a little bit, then there's more voltage on one side than the other. Everybody see that? So you, it's very sensitive to the amount of displacement. In fact, you can, it's sensitive to the motion up of this tip by one atom. If it moves up by one atom, you can tell it at the top by the electronics, right? And what you do, just to go into more detail than I normally would, there's a ceramic cylinder in here, and a high voltage is put on it. And this ceramic, when it feels voltage, expands or contracts, okay? And there's several different contacts on it. So if it's a cylinder, if you expand this side and expand this side, it moves down. If you contract them, change the voltage, it moves up. But suppose you expand this one and contract this one, what happens? It twists, right? One way or the other, and also back and forth. So you can move this tip around over a sample, up and down and so on, so that the laser is always in the same place. And you do it by moving the tip so it's always bent the same amount. When something pushes it up, you raise it up so it's not bent. Got the idea? Okay, so you can scan and get what the surface looks like underneath. Okay, and it's sensitive to less than one molecule change in height. Okay, so this is an atomic force microscope image, and it's color-coded to show the height. Okay, and the distance here is 5 microns. That's about 600 molecules. So we're not looking at individual molecules, but this is a crystal that's under here. So it has a flat surface of the crystal, you know, a given plane of molecules, and it's perfectly flat here. But then you see steps here going down, down, down. Actually, they're going down to the right. It's as if it were being lit by the sun setting in the west here. So you see that's in shadow because this is higher than that is, this is higher than that is, right? And these two pits were made by pushing down with that little tip and scratching a little bit to grind a little bit out, okay? Now this is the surface of a benzoin crystal and it's dissolving in 95% water and 5% propanol. And each of those ledges is one unit cell that's 1.7 nanometers high. This is the way old-fashioned record players used to work. You know, a needle went in a groove and it bounced around, and that's how you detected things, except it's on a really fine scale. Okay, now that larger pit is 5.1 nanometers deep, so it's three unit cells of this crystal deep. But now as it dissolves, those expand, right? And we get down then to the, now here's the first step down, the second, and that's, remember, it was three layers. Okay? So you can see, for example, in this, that it dissolves faster in some directions than others, and you can try to figure out why it doesn't dissolve all directions the same amount. That's why this was being done. Okay? Or here's something even better. This was done by George Flynn, who was a student at Yale, but is now a professor at Columbia University and has been for a long time. But this is looking at this long chain of CH2s, 11, and then bromine on one end and a carboxylic acid in the other. And this was done more than 10 years ago, so things are even better now. But you see, these are individual molecules that have bromine on one end and this brown color is oxygen on the other end. Right? So you can see individual molecules and you can almost see atoms within the molecule. Okay, like there's one molecule, right? And if you, this is just an artist's impression of what it's like, and it's sitting on graphite, right? That's what lines it up. So these molecules just were adsorbed on graphite, and they went down right side by side, sort of a two-dimensional crystallization. Or you may have, this was a long time ago. That's about when you were born, right? But this was one of the very first accomplishments of what's called scanning tunneling microscope microscopy, which is very similar, but it doesn't bend anything. What it has is a really fine wire that comes down, and you put a voltage on the stuff down here and a voltage on the wire and measure the current. And when it gets close enough, electrons can tunnel. And we're going to talk about how tunneling works when we get to quantum mechanics. But the tunneling rate of electrons, that is how much current you get, depends very, very sensitively on small distances. So you get a very different current as you get close, right? So again, you do the same trick of keeping it at a constant current by raising it or lowering the tip as the surface goes up or down. And because the wire can be so very thin, thinner than something you have to push on, like the atomic force microscope, you can see individual atoms. But the sample has to conduct electricity to do that. And that's what these are, individual atoms of iron on a surface of copper. And you can actually pick them up by changing the voltage, pick up an atom and drop it down. So they started with this pattern and started assembling, and they made this whole ring. Isn't that cute? They also spelled out IBM in a thing. Okay, now I want to show you something different here. The question of resolution, this is a new demonstration for me. So I got to get the screen up a little bit. Okay. Whoops, stop it. And get some light on the screen here. There we go. Okay, now, I have a new way to draw a straight line on the, you know, it's often, even if you're not a very good artist, it's hard to draw things neatly on the blackboard. So I got, to be able to draw a straight line, I got this thing. Okay, so I just go like this. I haven't patented it yet. Okay. Now suppose there were bumps on the surface like these. Then what am I going to get? A straight line? If the bump stays. So it's going to look like this. Okay, it'll be a straight line. Oh. Maybe I can keep that up there. Thank you, John. My lovely assistant here will do it for me. Okay, so it's going to look like this. Good, now you can let that one go. Thank you. Okay, so I know there were two things on the surface, right? Do these look like those boxes? Why not? So now we're going to put it here. So let's try again. And see if you can figure out what lesson I'm showing you. Oh, what's that? I wanted to, so far so good, but I wanted to make a new picture. Not quite so far. I want to do one more. There we go. Yeah, that does it. And now the last one, John. You can move it over one. Up there. Okay, what did we learn from this? About seeing atoms in molecules.
You can always tell that there's something there, but you don't know what it is or how many or what it looks like.
Yeah, but can you think of a way I could have done this better than using this? If I used a really small wheel, then it would track much more faithfully, right? I can't get these narrower than the wheel allows. Everybody see that? And this is a question of what's called resolution. How far apart, how close can things be and you can still tell that they're two things? Right? It must be that the probe you're using to measure them has to be small compared to the distance between the things. Otherwise, it's going to look like this. Got the idea? So, if we want to look at so this is called resolution. And let me get some of these turned off. There we go. And put the screen back down. So you think that was worth doing? I invented that myself this morning before class. I've still got one more light here. Okay. So this is a picture from just last year of a molecule called pentosine, which is this molecule here. It's like sort of five benzene rings in a row, all mushed together, right? And it's going to be sitting on carbon, and we're going to scan with a tip that's a single atom, and it's done at 5 Kelvin. So here's the looking sideways. It's on copper, so we can do this conducting thing. This is scanning tunneling microscopy, so it's electricity, not bending the lever that's going to show us. Okay. Here's the molecule, that molecule sitting down here. And we're using a single gold atom to get a profile of that molecule. Right? And it moves back and forth the same way I talked about bending that cylinder. And you measure how high it is. Fine, you get a profile of that, the surface of that thing. Or they allowed CO molecules to absorb onto the copper surface. And then you could scan over that too. So they moved the tip over a little bit and scanned. And here's the picture they got plotting the height as a function of two-dimensional position. Right? And here's one CO, and there's the other CO. Right? Now, there's a certain... Do you think that diameter of that thing is the diameter of the CO molecule, or can you think any reason that it might not be? What? Yeah, let me see what's here. Gold atoms are big, and you can't see something. You can't see something smaller than that. I mean, you'll see that it's there, but it'll be like these things. It'll be way too fat. So what do you need? You need a smaller atom, and this is cool. So they put 2.5 volts on this gold compared to the copper. Now that doesn't sound like very much. I mean, you get that out of a battery, right? Or two batteries, more than that, right? But it's over a very small distance. So it's the field is 10 to the 10th volts per meter, right? So zap, it turns the CO molecule over and picks it up and holds it onto the gold. What's good about that? Now you have an oxygen atom to do the scanning with. So now they go over. Now, you see, that one's gone. They only see the other one now. But you're seeing it with the other CO2 as the other CO molecule as a tip. And then they put it on this molecule, and then they scan, or a bunch of them, and they see all these pentosine molecules as to their height. Okay? Actually, their conductivity that has to do with how close you are to them, right? And there it is, right? And these, what they actually observe is the frequency of vibration of this little thing changes when it's closer or when it's further. And this is the vibration, this light color is the vibration when it's close, and this is the dark color is when it's far. So they can see, you know, they get this. So you're really great, right? You believe that it's pentosine, but it doesn't have the resolution necessary to show the pair of electrons in there, if there is a pair of electrons in there. So it's close, but no cigar yet. Okay? So this is scanning near-field optical microscopy. We're going to talk in just a minute about the problem with optical microscopes for seeing things like this. And they often say you can't see things that are really small with shorter than the wavelength, closer than the wavelength of the light. That's a resolution problem too. But in fact, here it's a little bit different. You scan it, so it's just like these other tips. You move it back and forth across the top and see when there's something underneath this tip. And there's a glass fiber that's drawn down to be very narrow, to be just 100 nanometers here. We're not seeing individual atoms or even individual molecules unless they're big molecules with this. 100 nanometers is not compared. We were looking at 1 nanometer before or smaller, right? Okay, so it's coated with aluminum, so they can send light down and it'll stay inside the glass fiber and come out as a 100 nanometer wide beam here at the bottom, which is much narrower than the wavelength of the light. Okay? Now they have it really close to the surface that they want to image. And what the thing they're trying to image now is a sample that has a few molecules in it that fluoresce. So when they get hit by light of one wavelength, they give off light of another wavelength. And what they want to know is where those molecules are. So you see what they do? They have the light comes in, blue light. It hits a molecule and comes out as red light. And they just have a lens down here that's on the line with where the light comes in. And if it glows, then you detect it. Okay? Now they just scan this thing around the surface, back and forth like a TV. Right, and find out when red light comes out. That's when the molecule is within that 100 nanometers. Right, so here's a thing where a surface of some nano-fabricated material that had molecules that were fluorescent in it, and you can see that this is the wavelength of the red light, but in fact you're seeing things that are considerably smaller than that. Okay. So here we've talked about three different ways of doing scanning probe microscopy, SPM. We've seen force and current, tunneling current, and here light. So there are lots and lots of different ways of doing this. There are magnetic ways, for example, to do it. So these scanning probe microscopies, which have only been around as long as you have, or not much longer, which doesn't seem very long to me, although it seems a long time to you, are really, really powerful. And if you have a sufficiently sharp point, you can resolve individual molecules and even atoms within molecules, as we saw, but not bonds. So unfortunately, this isn't going, feeling in this way isn't going to answer our problem. Okay? But you know the motto of Yale, that light has to do with the truth. Okay, so let's try light. If you go along Prospect Street here, this is our building just over there, and you look, there's this old delivery area there, and you've noticed a lot of decorations on the outside of the building, and some of them are chemical apparatus, and this is one. Is that something you associate with chemistry? What do you associate it with, Megan? It's biology, right? A microscope. But it's put on a chemistry building. That's interesting. Now, and there's Robert Hooke, who we talked about. He drew this. Imagine people in 1665 opening this book and seeing fleas when they had fleas and knowing that they looked like that. Okay, that's from Micrographia. He said, but nature is not to be limited by our narrow comprehension. Future improvements of glasses, that's microscopes or lenses, may yet further enlighten our understanding, and ocular inspection may demonstrate that which is yet, we think, too extravagant either to feign or suppose. So maybe with just light, if we get good enough lenses, we can see these things. Right? Now, what's the problem with Hooke's suggestion here for seeing the pairs of electrons? The wavelength of the light. You can't resolve things closer than the wavelength of the light by normal microscopes. And this, the way you see things with light, the way I'm seeing you, has to do with what's called interference upon scattering. And you've seen a very simple example of that when you've seen oil on water and see the rainbow colors in it. You've all seen that, I'm sure. Okay. So suppose you had a layer of oil that's 200 nanometers thick on water, and light comes in and bounces both from the air-oil interface and from the oil-water interface. Okay, and both these beams then come out together. But suppose, so the path difference of the one that goes a long way and the one that goes a shorter path is about 400 nanometers. Not exactly, there's an angle that comes in there, but roughly 400 nanometers. Now suppose the light that you used had a wavelength of one, that suppose that path difference was one wavelength, right? Then the light comes in, and it's just one wavelength behind, so they're maxima at the same time, so it comes out very strong. Okay? On the other hand, if you'd used a different color light instead of purple-red, so that 400 nanometers is only half the wavelength, right? Then, when they bounce, what'll happen? One is a maximum, when the other is a minimum, they cancel out, you don't get anything. Okay, so that's what different thicknesses of oil then will selectively scatter different wavelengths of light. That's why you see the rainbows. That's why you see Newton's rings that we talked about this morning, that kind of interference. Now, Hooke, in this book, Micrographia, Observation 9, was about the colors observable in mica and other thin bodies. And he had, this is a diagram of his, which suggests that light can come in, it's a pulse, he thinks, and it bounces from the top, but it can also, and moves on out then, and it can bounce also from the bottom, from the bottom surface. So you get actually pairs of pulses coming out in his theory, a strong one followed by a weak one at a certain time interval. Okay? And that particular pattern of strong then weak at that interval, he says, gives you yellow. The eye senses yellow. If you had two layers of this kind of the mica, then there's a bigger lag between them, right? So, and that bigger lag, the eye senses is red, according to Hooke. And if you have a still bigger one, then what the eye sees is not, it sees a weak pulse followed by a strong pulse. See what I mean? Rather than strong followed by weak, it's the next one coming, of course. And that's blue. So that's Hooke's theory of colors, the pulses. Now, that's very close to what happens when you use X-rays to see atoms and molecules. And if you have time after we finish here, I'll take you and show you these machines, which were brand new at this time last year. So there are two of them there. They got a package deal. One cost $200,000, and it's this one. And the idea is that on a little fiber there, you mount a crystal, a tiny crystal that's maybe a tenth of a millimeter or less. Couldn't be much less than that. And here's an X-ray tube, and X-rays come down and hit the crystal and get scattered. And then there's a CCD detector that these scattered X-ray things hit, and that's electronically recorded. And the other one that cost almost twice as much money has a curved detector, what's called an image plate. And there the X-rays come down and hit a tiny crystal, and you can get more of them over bigger angles, okay, because of this different image plate. So that scattering is what allows you to see the electrons in molecules. So you see, but the question is, can in this way, what's good about X-rays rather than just using a regular old microscope? The wavelength is much shorter. It's half an angstrom, right? So it's the order of magnitude of these distances we're interested in. So we might be able to see individual molecules or atoms or bonds. But there's a problem, of course, which is the wavelength, and that's what we just addressed. But to look at this a little more carefully, we might think of what is light. So who knows what light is? Pardon me? Waves of photons. So what's wavy about it? I've seen waves. So electromagnetic waves, you could call it. So in what way is light a wave? What's wavy about it? I mean, this idea of Hooke had that there were pulses, I can see that. Okay, but what's wave? What's a wave? What, a graph you draw of light is a wave, right? What we might plot is, remember, it's electromagnetic. How do you know there's an electric field someplace? How can you measure an electric field? If there's an electric field and you put a charge there, there's a force on it. If you measure the force, that tells you how strong the electric field is. So we could measure the force on a charge at a particular position as a, and it could be forced up or it could be forced down. The field could go either way. And so suppose the charged particle's over there. And as light goes by, we see a force up and then down and then up and then down and then up and then down. Okay? It varies in time. If we made a graph of this where the force is plotted vertically and time is plotted horizontally, we get a wave. So that's the sense in which it's a wave. Its force is a function of time at a given position. Or we could take, and that's at one position. If we take different positions, right, at the same instant, then if you're here, the force is up there, it's down there, it's up there, it's down there, it's up there, it's down, okay? So there's the same wave, but this is force as a function of position rather than time because the wave is moving along. Okay, so that's our wave. Now, this got screwed up somehow in going from one of my computers to the other. But what creates light? What creates light is electrons being or charges being accelerated. Okay? So remember, we detect light by the force on a charge, right? But what generates light is a charge being accelerated. So suppose we have a charge there, an electron, let's say, and a light field comes along and hits it and causes it to move up and down. But it's being accelerated up and down causes it to give off light. So that's scattering. Right? But even though the light that came in was going just this direction, the direct beam, the light that gets scattered goes almost all directions. Any direction from which you can see that the thing is moving, light is coming out. There's one direction, if you were straight up above it, you wouldn't see it moving because it would be going like this, right? You wouldn't see it move. There, light doesn't come. But it goes all directions. So that's scattering. So if you see scattering of light, you send light in, you see scattering, you know there was some charged particle there. You've detected it. That could be like this scanning near-field optical microscope, right? You could move around until you see light coming out, then you know there was something there. But we want to do something much higher resolution than that. So, now, incidentally, I said it's electrons that are scattering light. Why not protons or other nuclei, heavier nuclei like uranium? Why don't they scatter light? Pardon me? Why are they not accelerated? What? Well, but a nucleus has a positive charge. In fact, they have a very big positive charge. Aha! It weighs a lot, so it doesn't get accelerated very much. So it doesn't give off much. So it's electrons that you see with X-rays. Okay, the others are too heavy. Okay, now you've seen ripples from rain on a pond. And you know that the patterns you get can be very complicated. So if you have a lot of electrons in there, you get very complicated patterns. But now we're going to look here. So suppose you have just two electrons, right? And they're both being made to scatter light, and those are the waves that come out. Okay, maxima and minima. But if you look, there's a pattern to it. Right? See, the big maxima and minima come along those paths, and in between there's hardly any variation at all. So light will be scattered in certain directions. What determines these directions? If you have two electrons there. Suppose the two electrons were right exactly on top of one another, or really, really, really close to one another, then what? It would go in all directions, because they'd always be doing the same thing. It would be rings that would come out. So can you see what it is that determines the angle at which things come out? Christina? Pardon me? The distance between them. Okay? So we could measure the distance by measuring these angles at which the light comes out. So angular intensity distribution at a great distance, on short distances, comparable to the separation, they're curves, these things. But as you get out there, they become straight lines, any sensible distance that you could measure it from. Okay, and that'll depend on the scatterer distribution at the origin, right? That's for two. There could be any number of electrons that would be doing it. Okay? So by a lens, if you put a lens out there, it refocuses all those scattered beams from however many electrons are there. It'll refocus and make an image of what was doing it, but it can make it bigger. So you can enlarge it, and then you can see. But the problem is that you can't do it in this case because there's not a lens that'll work for X-rays. Right? So you have a lens for optical things, but the wavelength is too long. You have short enough wavelengths for X-rays, but there's no way to focus it to get the image. So you have to somehow understand how it is that those angles at which things come out tell you about the structure of the things that's doing the scattering at very small scale. And we can understand, but a lens for X-rays is hard to come by. And there's a web page that I'm sure you'll find useful about this, so read it. Okay, so we want to see molecules, atoms, bonds collectively. Remember that scanning near-field optical microscope looks molecule by molecule and sees it. But here the scattering is coming from all the electrons in the sample. So it's much more complicated to figure out what it's telling you. Okay, SPM, scanning probe microscope, feels them individually, but this is a collective phenomenon. Now, suppose you had carbon atoms like this. Let's call them benzene molecules, and it's in two dimensions, right? That's what a real crystal might look like. Some of them are a little displaced from where they ought to be. Some of them might be missing and stuff like that as they're vibrating and the crystal's imperfect. So what does that do to things? If you see the collective average of all these, there's a blurring problem, right? Because one's displaced a little this way, one's displaced a little this way. If you see some average of them, you see something that's blurred out. Okay? So there's averaging in time, because it takes some time to do the experiment. There's averaging in space, because it's cooperative. They're all doing the scattering. But this is if you want to see the defects, there's an advantage for scanning probe microscopy, which operates in what's called real space, actually shows individual molecules. But this X-ray is going to be a different sort of thing. X-rays were discovered by Röntgen in 1895, and he took a picture of his wife's hand, as you know. But in 1912, Lowy invented X-ray diffraction. So that this is a completely different phenomenon. It's not a shadow the way it is for Röntgen. It's this cooperative scattering from all the electrons, which gives a pattern. And Sir Lawrence Bragg, later Sir Lawrence Bragg, at this time was only 21 years old. And he figured out how to do it, how to interpret those things that have been deflected at different angles to give a pattern there. How to use that to find out what the structure of the crystal, how the atoms were arranged in the crystal. And he was therefore the youngest Nobel laureate. In 1915 he got the Nobel Prize, just 3 years later. And his father shared it with him, although he's the one who did all the work. Okay, now, have you ever seen this? What? Aisha? It's DNA, and what does it show about DNA? That it's a double helix with major and minor grooves. Is that what it looks like? Right. So what we want to understand is how it is that this scattering can tell you that that's a double helix with major and minor grooves. Okay. So that's Rosalind Franklin's picture. And in fact, 10 years ago in science, people from Yale in this department and in MB&B did the structure of the ribosome, for which they got the Nobel Prize this last year. So that's much more complicated than this other stuff. It's 250 angstroms across. It's more than 100,000 atoms, not counting the hydrogens, right? So what can X-ray diffraction show? Can it show molecules? Yeah. Atoms? Yeah. Bonds? That's what we're interested in, okay? And so we want to understand a little bit about how diffraction works, so we can see, you know, we can be we don't want to be masters of a jewel we don't know how to wear. Okay, so like all light, X-rays are waves. So we have this wave machine here that I want to show you. So here, suppose this thing here, and this are electrons, and here's a wave that's coming in here. Okay? So it hits these at the same time and forces them to vibrate up and down. And as they vibrate up and down, they give off light in all directions. Remember, almost all directions. And they interfere with one another. Right? So this wave and this wave get added together. If you're way, way out there, these look like the same waves. They're not coming from different positions on the scale of your eye, right? They're an angstrom apart. So those two waves are coming from the same place at a given angle, right? And you can see what would happen is that you get very strong light, because whenever this one is a maximum, this one is a maximum. Got it? In fact, we have a line here that helps us measure that. But suppose we use, instead of coming straight ahead like that, suppose we used a different angle like that. How about if we looked at that angle way out there where that's a different position from the beam that came straight ahead? What do we see at that angle? All right? Destructive. They one's up, one the other's down. There's no net force. Nothing. So suppose we go here. Right? Now it's strong again. Then it's weak again, then it's strong again, then it's weak again, then it's strong again. So here we got this one reinforced with that one when they were straight ahead, then this one, then this one, then this one. We're out here to pretty near a 45 degree angle. Maybe we go a little bit further. The 45 degree angle gets us 1, 2, 3, 4 new waves where it's constructive. Everybody with me? Now suppose instead of that, suppose we had things that were closer together, like this, right? Now, we start going here, and we get to where we would have had the first wave, the first constructive interference, right? If it had been just the top and the bottom. And what do we see? What about the one in the middle? It's destructive. Now, suppose you had a whole row of these things equally spaced, 58,000 of them, equally spaced. What would you see coming out at that angle? How much light would be coming out at that particular angle? Nothing, because the second one would cancel the first one, the fourth one you'd cancel the third one, every pair would cancel, and there wouldn't be anything, right? And then if we went here, what would happen? Now it's very strong because they're all in phase. But again, then here they would cancel. I mean, we don't see the whole row of them here, right? So you'd only see half as many angles, right? Every other one would cancel that you would have seen had they been further apart. So the further apart they are, the closer together the angles are. Does everybody see that? Right? If you looked at just the top and the bottom, you have this angle, this angle, this angle, this angle, this angle. But if they're closer together, the light is further apart. Right? You only get it at this angle, and this angle, and this angle. Right? You don't get as many, and they're further apart in angle. So there's a reciprocal relationship here. The closer things are in real space, the further they apart in angles. Okay? Good. So, now suppose that they weren't evenly spaced. Suppose they were like this, where they're in pairs, the first pair close together, then another pair, another pair, another pair. Got the plan? Now, remember these first ones, this one and this one, and the fifth and the seventh and the ninth and so on, are going to be constructively interfering there and there and there and there. Now, how's the total strength going to be? It'll be all those adding together, all the odd ones, first, third, fifth, so on, right? We'll be constructive at those angles, that one, that one, that one, okay? What effect is this one going to have on that? So suppose we go to the first one, where it would be strong for all the odd ones being together. What's this one doing? Tends to cancel it. So that first reflection is going to be very weak, right? Almost canceled by the even-numbered ones. Now, let's go to the next one. How about that one? Still a little weak, right? Better, but still a little bit weak. Now let's go to the next one. Now that's pretty strong. See what I mean? And then we go to the next one. That's really weak. And the next one is going to be very strong. So you see that you get a funny pattern. It's not, if they were evenly spaced, remember it was strong, zero, strong, zero, strong, zero. But this is a funny pattern, right, that's coming along. Okay, so that's the kind of thing in three dimensions that you're going to interpret. That's the wave machine. You can see a thing like that on the web, but I think it's more fun to play with it manually, I think. So you can go there if you want to see how these things interfere. I'm not going to spend time on this now, about these successive ones being in or out of phase. Now, there are two directions of scattering that are always exactly in phase, right? Because if the light's coming in that one, this one will start vibrating sooner than that one, but then it takes longer for it to get. So the direct light is always going to be in phase from these two, no matter where they are. Everybody see how that works? Got it? Okay. But there's another angle. Because suppose they go at that angle, then if this distance is the same as this distance, and this distance is the same as this distance, then those will be in phase too. Got the idea? But at other angles, it wouldn't be true. Just that angle. That's a special angle. Can you see what the angle is? That's called that, from where it would have been in the direct to where it is now, turns out to be technically called the scattering vector. But if that scattering vector is perpendicular to a plane, or line in this case, on which the electrons lie, then they're bound to be in phase, and you know this. How do you know that the light is going to be in phase if it comes in at some angle to a plane of stuff and comes out at the same angle? How do you know that it's going to be in phase? Aisha, do you have an idea? That's what a mirror does. Right? Everything in the plane scatters in phase. So the light comes in at a given angle, goes out at the same angle. No matter where these electrons are, as long as they're in the same plane, that if they scatter in that direction, that's characterized by what's called that scattering vector, which means the angle in, angle out are the same, then it works. Everything's in phase. But other angles, it won't work. Okay? Unless... So that's called specular reflection. A speculum is Latin for a mirror. Okay. Now, so if you had another one there, however it's spaced, as long as it's on the same line, you'll get scattering in that direction from all three. So all the electrons on a plane perpendicular to the scattering vector scatter in phase at the specular angle. Now, but suppose you had a whole complicated bunch of these things. Now, where is that going to be in phase? This is hard to see. Right? But there's a way of seeing it. Look at this. Notice that pattern, they lie on planes that are evenly spaced. These planes are evenly spaced. There are three electrons on that, four here, two here, one there. But if you can pick out a set of planes that are evenly spaced, then you can get scattering because all the ones on this plane are going to be in phase at that mirror angle, the specular angle. How could these possibly be in phase with these? Because, you know, the light comes in to these and bounces out, but it's got a longer path to get here and bounce out at the same angle. How could they possibly be in phase? How could they reinforce one another? All right? If you have one wavelength between them. Okay, then it'll be like the thing we saw before. Now, for purposes of reckoning, we can collapse them all. Everything on a plane is on one of these planes is going to be in phase, so we could all be in the same place. So we could just condense them like this, and now we see that if that we have that reflection, it's scattering at the mirror angle, and there are three electrons doing that, right? And there are four electrons there, but if that difference, the red, is one wave, then we're golden. Those are going to reinforce one another. Okay? So that depends on what the wavelength is, and it's also what the angle is. Right? Okay, but if you have them right, then that'll be so. And then that one would be two waves, and that one would be three waves, and they all add together. And you get, as if it were at that particular angle of that particular wavelength, you get in phase scattering, as if 10 electrons are all scattering at the same time, exactly the same. Okay? Now, suppose the first path difference was half a wavelength. Then what? If we're going to do the same accounting. So we get 3 electrons from the first. What do we get from the second one? Minus 4. Right? Well, I think I got that. What am I doing here? There, 3, then minus 4, then plus 2, then minus 1, and in toto, 0. There wouldn't be any scattering at that angle. But the idea is, what you can see is how the intensity that's coming out at different angles depends on what the pattern of the electrons are, and how you can understand that if you can perceive these evenly spaced planes of electron density in the sample. So, now we're going to do a trick. This is the end of the, you'll be happy to know, the lecture. Okay, so back in the back there, you can see a red glow, right? So John's going to lift out the piece of paper. And here you can see a laser hitting the screen that has a given wavelength, 633 nanometers. Okay, so we're looking down from the ceiling on this plot. Okay, so here's the light coming and it hits the screen, right? And it's 10.6 meters from there to the screen. Okay? And what he's going to do, not yet, but when I tell him to do so, is put in there something that's a pattern that will scatter this light the same way you would scatter X-rays, except his pattern is bigger than atoms, and the wavelength is longer than X-rays. Okay, but it's exactly the same phenomenon. Now, the scattered stuff won't be nearly as strong as the direct beam. Okay? So I'm going to put this thing here, what's called a beam stop, and it's also used in X-ray things, right there, and I'm going to try to trap the beam so it doesn't saturate your eyes, and you can see the... here we go. Yeah, that's pretty good. Okay. And we're going to see what the pattern looks like of this, what angles light's coming out of that laser light from different patterns. Now, the first pattern is going to be jail bars like this. Okay? And the next pattern, there's a question for you to solve. This, you know, you're going to have an angle at which this one will reinforce this one, this one, this one, this one, when the light comes in and goes at a certain angle. It's just what we've been talking about. So I want you to figure out how far apart these lines are on his mask he's going to put in there by measuring the angles or the distance between spots on the screen. Got the idea? So that's a question for you to do. Then we're going to look at pairs of lines. That's like this one I did where you remember there's two not evenly spaced, two and then two and then two and then two. So we're going to look at that one. Then we're going to look at a random collection of hexagons of dots. Like benzene, we'll call it random benzene. Okay? And then this one, which again looks random, but it's not. Can you see the sense in which it's not random? They all come as pairs. Right? Here's a pair. Wait a second, that's not it. The pairs are shown here. Here's a pair, here's a pair, here's a pair, here's a pair. So it's random collection of pairs. Okay? And then this one, which is a random collection of parallelograms. See what I mean? And then finally we're going to have a lattice, a two-dimensional benzene regular lattice. And we're going to see what these are like. Okay, and then our pièce de résistance is going to be scattering by a light bulb filament. Can you see why that might be interesting? Well, you'll see shortly. So let's do this. And it has to be dark in here to see these well, especially when we get to the light bulb filament. I'm going to put this over here. Okay, this is the end of the lecture, so I'm going to stop the lecture there. I'm not sure that the timing worked. But I'm going to turn this off. Sorry, I got to turn these projectors off. And turn this one off. And thank you. You know, that thing's held on there by a magnet. And I ran that magnet up into there once and it stuck and I had to get a ladder and climb up there. Thank you. That saved me, maybe even my life. It's hard to remember everything. Okay, now the doors are closed, turn the room lights off. So John's going to show us first just jail bars, then pairs of bars, then random benzenes, pairs of benzenes, quartets of benzene, benzene crystal, and finally the light bulb filament. Okay. Now I got to cover this so you don't get any light from that. Where did I put the box? Oh, here it is. There it is. Okay, there we go. Okay, so that's the scattering from vertical jail bars. And you see, I think it's 10 point, it's on the problem set, but the distance between successive spots here, these two spots, is I think 10 centimeters or whatever it is, it's on the problem set. And from that, you can get what the distance between, if you know the wavelength and the distance from the source to the screen, you can get how far apart the bars are. Now, John's going to twist the slide around a vertical axis. What's happening? They're getting further apart. Because as he twists it, it looks like the bars are getting closer together. Do you see that? Say yes. Okay, so that makes the spots go further apart, this reciprocal relationship. Okay, now he's going, that's rotated about a horizontal axis. Okay, now he's going to put in pairs of bars with the same spacing, pair to pair, as between individual ones before. And now what do you see? Or actually they're closer, or they're further apart, I guess. But what do you see? It's evenly spaced dots, but they have different intensity. Right? The fact that they are pairs means that it's a pattern that's being repeated infinitely. And that pattern determines is what determines the intensities. And the distance pair to pair to pair to pair is what determines the spacing. So this is as in X-ray, you have a crystal lattice. The molecules are separated by a certain amount, and it's repeated and repeated and repeated. That determines where you see the spots. But the arrangement of electrons within the molecules determines the intensity of the spots. Okay, now we're going to look at random benzene. Okay, so it looks sort of like a snowflake, right? So it turns out that if things are arranged randomly, patterns are arranged randomly, you see the same intensity that you would see for just one of them, but they all add together rather weakly. This is characteristic of the structure of a benzene molecule. And now we're going to do pairs and then quartets and finally a whole crystal. And when we have this regular repeat in a lattice, then we're going to see only certain angles. So now, John, hold on to that one while you put the next one in. The pairs, yeah. Now, so what you see is that they're bars across, but it's the same pattern. Actually, you don't need to hold that. I think everybody believes it's the same pattern, but it has these bars across it. Okay, the bars point out to like 2 o'clock on a clock, right? Up a little bit to the right is the direction the bars go. But it's the same pattern, the same molecule is doing the scattering, but there are pairs of them. Now do quartets. Can anybody guess what it's going to look like? There are going to be bars going 2 directions. Right? Right? And now we're going to go to really long repeats, right? Many, 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 many. And now you need exactly a certain angle in order to get it. Isn't that nice? I thought I would get a response. And you can see them way out there. So this focuses the light. So it's the same light that's coming from all these molecules, but first it's very diffuse because you don't have to have exactly the right angle. Right? But once you have a long, long row of it, if you don't have exactly the angle, the 31st will cancel the first, the 32nd will cancel the second, the 33rd will cancel the third. Right, if they're just off by a little bit. So they have to be exactly the right angle if you have a long row. But an underlying intensity is the same. It's that same snowflake pattern as if it were viewed through a pegboard. Do you people know what a pegboard is? I'll show you a picture next time. Okay. And finally, we're going to do the helix. The light bulb filament, yeah. And what do you see? It's hard to see if you're far back. How would you describe the pattern? It's an X of dots, right? Can people see it? That there's actually, it's not in the light very well now. There it is. Can people see it? There's an X. And along each bar of the X, there are a row of dots. And so next time, we'll interpret how that shows that it's a double helix with major and minor grooves. Okay, now we'll have some light. You can go home. Thank you for accommodating me with this thing. Okay. Good. Turned out I forgot to time this thing. I'll put it on the web. It won't be timed, but you can step through it. And I'll time it myself and put it on to synchronize it with this.